subcommittee of the subcommittee to order for public safety. We're starting the administrative section of the Department of Justice. We left off right at the end with you, Frank, and I think we were going to head into the information technology arena, the administrative division.
That's correct. Chair Patridge, members of the committee, the next area I'd like to cover is information technology, and I'm sure you would like me to go through this very slow and drawn out.
Okay.
So that you have plenty of time. But
slow and drawn out. My goal today is to be done by 2:30, just so everyone knows what the chair's expectations are.
Well, I was hoping to get that response.
Good.
Okay. I'll move forward with this. So I separated it out so that you could have a better sense of what's happening in the IS arena. There were a number of questions that came up in the last O1 session, and so I wanted to kind of broaden this presentation and give a little bit more meat to it. The first slide shows our purpose and goal. The overriding IS purpose is to provide technology resources to meet the business requirements of the department and its programs. We do this in a variety of ways. We manage the acquisition, development, implementation, maintenance of technology resources for the agency. Next slide, please. There are areas of operation that we have. We actually have three areas of operation that we work in, the first one being administrative services. This is where we provide a centralized agency network management and also where we have legal applications. A lot of those are commercial applications that are primarily to support the legal divisions. The second area of operation that we have is a division of child support. The primary focus there is the development and maintenance of the child support enforcement automated system, which we refer to as CSIS, also network operations for the 16 DCS field offices. And the third area of operation is one that seems to be growing, and this is in our Criminal Justice Division, which is the location for the Criminal Intelligence Database System and connectivity to national and local law enforcement systems. And that is being, to a large extent, improved and enhanced through federal funds via the HIDTA program. I'd like to talk a little bit about just service delivery and service delivery areas. They mainly fall into the following categories: providing network service, providing customer support. As I mentioned, we have some commercial software applications. We get involved in that, especially in the legal arena, and software development. Just to highlight some of the functions that we provide under each of those, for instance, under the network area, we have management of the network and management of the servers in there. Under customer support, we provide the normal types of things that would occur, like the installation and maintenance of desktop software and help desk problem resolution for the staff. Under commercial software, we acquire and install commercial software, and we provide upgrades and patches to other types of commercial software. We try and not reinvent the wheel unless there isn't a wheel out there that we can get to. In software development, of course, we design, construct, and manage data systems. To give an example, I have a couple of those listed, but just one in particular, the Crime Victims Assistance Case Management System, is one of those items that we built as the Crime Victims Assistance section has grown in size. It also needed some more IS infrastructure in order to help it meet its particular needs. Software development under the child support area, the Child Support Enforcement Automated System. One of the particular areas here I think that is very beneficial and something that ought to be pointed out is that we are only one of 20 states currently that has a certified system by the federal government. So we are in the upper 50 percentile of what's going on nationally there. Under Criminal Justice Division, we have a couple of areas, of course, criminal intelligence. We are involved in software development there. And also in, we call it geo deconfliction, as geographic deconfliction, where we have different law enforcement agencies, so we don't have somebody trying to be a buyer and a seller that are both law enforcement, basically. Factors affecting service, There's a couple things that are impinging and coming down on us. National medical support notice basically involves the child support division and involves their particular automated systems, which is a mainframe application. Security and system security threats are another big thing, and the confidentiality of data, the system security threats are something, as you read in the paper, you see occasions where there are articles about the number of hits. We also take a lot of those hits, and because we have connectivity to a lot of national security law enforcement information, that's even more critical for us to make sure that we have firewalls installed. Also, homeland security is another one of those areas that's emerging and somewhat ties in with the HIDTA project and Criminal Justice Division. Interagency and intergovernmental programs that we get involved in, and the Child Support Division, we interface with the DHS data system. Also, that system, as you well know, is used by district attorneys throughout the state. On the HIDTA area, that area of criminal justice, the online access to criminal and justice, criminal intelligence data by a law enforcement agency that's used statewide by a lot of local law enforcement agencies. Also, there's another program there that manages gang-related intelligence program, or it's called a GRIP database, which is another statewide database. And legal services, we use mainly what you're involving there in terms of working with government is electronic sending of information, a lot of text that's going to be sent electronically and shared throughout state government. Budget notes and directions. One of the requests out of the 01 session was improved tracking of hardware and software expenses. I mentioned this when I went through the other component part of the admin budget presentation, and I do have information available for that for you if you'd like to see it. Also, there was a request for hosting the child support website in the DAS system. That project is pending, waiting for DAS to add more capacity. We are fully involved with them and working with them, waiting for their ability actually to accept us. Security project.
We had them before, and they have more than enough capacity, so I guess I'm wondering where the rub is between IRMD and their hosting and you guys. So if you can check that out, I would be interested in getting back.
Okay.
That was my understanding, because there was more than sufficient capacity.
Thank you, Chair Patridge.
I think that was Representative Butler's understanding.
Was that? Okay. So we will check that out and get back to you on that, because that is a direction that we agreed with, we want to comply with, and we've been pretty much waiting in the wings on.
Okay.
The next item was the security project that we had presented in the 01 session. The slide indicates that it was the third pending development of the enterprise security plan by DAS. That, unfortunately, I have not modified the slide. We made some modifications to our security. Again, Nancy Minden is here from our IS advisory group. If you'd like some more data and information on that, Nancy can kind of elaborate a little bit more on that particular area. In essence, we were able to do some cost-saving techniques. We used some software that's available where there was no cost involved, and we're able to implement a staged improvement in our software security, to the point where we will continue to improve and continue to look at security, because it is a major issue for our agency. We also, based on budget notes, we implemented Windows 2000 in our server networks. We did that in January of 2002 for legal divisions, and in June of 2002 for the child support division. One of the key areas, I think, that we've initiated in this last biennium is coming out of a note from the 01 session, was a review of our IT staffing levels. And we've completed reviews in both the legal services division areas and in the child support division areas. Actually, we've had two different reviews. We've had initially a conference of Western Attorney Generals come in and look at just overall agency operations to give us some feedback on where we might be able to make some improvements and how we're actually functioning. They suggested that we actually go out and get a contractor to do a specific IS review, in which case we did. A known contractor in the state system, ProDX, came in and did a review of the legal services areas and then a separate review of the child support division. The budget package that we have before you today in IS is one that has run through the sieve of the ProDX. In fact, it's a portion of the ProDX recommendation, and it is a continuation of positions that were approved in the last session. Accomplishments. I'd like to just talk a little bit about some of the things that were accomplished. The next few slides will give you a little bit more detail. I'll just highlight a couple of those. We did create an IT advisory group in the agency that's been very successful. Its involvement includes mainly administrators from the different areas. This has done a great deal to expand the knowledge and availability of the agency administration to focus on IT projects and areas of improvement wherever we can create efficiencies and further enhance our ability to do more with less, basically. Results from the 0103 policy package, as I mentioned, we implemented the Windows 2000 on the network. We replaced our old email system with Exchange 2000 and Outlook XP, which is working fine. Also, we were awarded federal certification, as I mentioned, of the Child Support Enforcement Automated System, one of less than 50% of the states in that area. We've also improved our citizen internet services. We have expanded our online forms. We've improved our forms designs. We've added additional content, trying to make ourselves more reachable by the public.
Did you provision any of the things that you've done through your accomplishments through DAS? I mean, are you availing yourself of any of the IRMD host data hosting, email services, any of those things, or did you do that all in your own shop and have your own data center and are hosting all your own stuff?
Chair Patridge, I'm going to have to defer that question.
Chair Patridge, for the record, I'm Nancy Minden. I'm an assistant director in the Oregon Child Support Program. Let me give you a little bit of background. To the extent that we consulted with IRMD all along the way when we were doing the studies, we invited them to be as involved as they had time to be. In terms of hosting, the Child Support Automated System is on the DHS mainframe. So you kind of take a lot of that, put that to the side. In terms of hosting on DAS, we've been, I would say, trying to collaborate with them for about the last year to get our web services over to their servers, hosted by them. Again, we're willing to do that, and we intend to do it. It's just a matter of when they're ready.
But what about your email provisioning, your other applications? Are you hosting? You're hosting all those yourself, like your own data? In your own data center, as opposed to.
I'm getting the nod from the front row that yes, we are hosting our own email and on our own servers.
Okay, thanks.
Continuing on with accomplishments, we've also implemented an online child support guidelines calculator for use with child support enforcement, calculating the amounts of child support enforcement that was owed. We've created an Oregon State Intelligence Network for use by federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. This, again, is a part of the HIDA project that is using federal funding. As I mentioned earlier, policy package 112, basically what we'd like to do there is continue as permanent two customer service help desk positions. What I'd like to mention about those is those positions, again, are self-funded, recognizing that the budget was in very general fund or other funds were in very short supply. We've looked at ways that we could economize and self-fund programs. This is one of those cases where we've been able to look at ways to self-fund those costs of these two positions within our own resources, and therefore there's actually no additional cost to the programs as a result. We'd like to continue as permanent one network support position which is HIDA funded, which is federally funded for the high intensity drug trafficking area.
Was that previously a limited duration position?
Chair Patridge, yes. What those positions will assist us with is in maintaining the productivity gains resulting from the IS policy package that was approved by the 01 session and providing continued technical support for the DOJ Intelligence Unit and Criminal Justice Division. That's the end of my presentation for administration. If I can answer any questions.
I just want to make sure. Did you explore hosting with gas or having gas provision your mail systems and the newly installed mail system?
Chair Patridge, I think we could look into that. I don't know because I wasn't part of the group that did that construction, but we could look into that and get back to you with that.
I'm just concerned because we were trying to direct people last session to try and get as much economies of scale, and everyone still went out, built their own email systems. I've seen 3 or 4 farms and budgets that you have your own email administrators mm-hmm. and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
That's a concern.
Chair Patridge, just checking with Jim Jorgensen, our IS manager, he participated on a committee with DAS and a number of other agencies looking at that concept of centralization in that area. Apparently that group disbanded. There was not a move to bring that forward. I cannot tell you the particulars other than we were with a group that was looking into that and involved with it, but there was something prevented it from moving forward.
Okay, well, I'd be interested to know who participated in that group, if you could maybe look through some old notes so that you can identify where that was, because that was definitely the direction that mm-hmm. we had asked it to go.
Okay, Chair Patridge.
Sometimes those things die of their own weight, I understand.
We'll present you with all the
but
info.
You want to
we
take
have.
Names anyway.
But I
want to.
All right. Well, thank you for participating in that. All right. Questions of the committee as to this particular section? All right. Thank you. Right, so I said at the beginning I'm going to try and get us out of here by 2:30. So. Members of the committee and the audience. Connie Gallagher is up next. The Crime Victims Program. If you will turn to that tab in your book. And mine's blank.
I think that's this one, isn't it?
Oh, check it. With the green.
Mm-hmm.
There's an addition. Okay. I think. Is there a presentation? Go ahead, Connie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm the director for the Crime Victims Assistance Section. I'm here today to talk to you about crime from the standpoint of victims, from the standpoint of an 81-year-old gentleman with Alzheimer's that was beaten by a female acquaintance and her accomplice, from the standpoint of a 3-year-old that was held down in a scalding bathtub by his mother, and from the standpoint of a 21-year-old Japanese exchange student who was sexually assaulted by her host father. These individuals, through no fault of their own, were victims of devastating acts of personal injury crimes. Fortunately, Oregon, like every other state in our country, believes that the right thing to do is to assist these victims to regain, to the extent that they're able, the ability to lead a safe, productive, and a satisfying life. The mission of our section is to provide assistance to such victims of violent crime through crime victims' compensation, grants, and technical assistance to the local providers throughout the state in an impartial, consistent, and compassionate manner. We have a staff of 27 individuals along with a dedicated fiscal coordinator. The funds that provide the services for crime victims in our state are primarily other funds and, to a lesser extent, federal funds. During the 2001 Legislative Assembly, however, we did receive the very first appropriation of general fund dollars that went out to local providers of services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. The next PowerPoint slide will show you a little bit more about how our revenue is spent. Although expenditure adjustments have been made, of course, during the course of this biennium, it's anticipated that about 73% of our available revenue will be distributed to local community providers. Approximately 16.7% of our revenue will go directly to crime victims through the Crime Victims Compensation Program, and approximately 10.3% will be used for the operational costs of our section. The next slide provides you with a bit more detail about our revenue stream. By and large, crime victim services in our state are supported through fines, fees, judgments, and assessments paid by offenders and others who are ordered by the court to make such payments through either a civil proceeding or a criminal proceeding. The sources, as you'll see on the slide, include unitary assessments, subrogation, which is the repayment of recovered expenses, punitive damages, restitution, and a small amount of other contributions, such as donations from offenders in the correctional facilities. Except for direct program appropriations, these funds go into the criminal injuries compensation account. This other fund revenue then goes back out to support a variety of different types of crime victim programs. Through the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program, these funds support the capacity of each county to provide a multidisciplinary response to child abuse, along with payment of quality assessments for alleged victims of child abuse. Through the Prosecutor-Based Victim Assistance Program, the funds provide assistance to victims of crime whose case is proceeding through the criminal justice system. The Crime Victims Compensation Program provides funds for direct reimbursement to victims of violent crime for their out-of-pocket costs. The funds also support state grants and, again, as I mentioned earlier, the operational costs for the section. At the very bottom of the slide, you'll note the general fund dollars that I mentioned earlier that support services to victims of domestic violence along with sexual assault services. You'll find more detail on each of these programs, including how much each county has received, along with each program within each county, at the very back of the green handout that I've provided for you. The Crime Victims Compensation Program was statutorily established in 1977. The purpose is to provide financial reimbursement to injured victims of crime and their families who have no other means of paying for the cost that they have incurred as a result of the victimization. The program also encourages cooperation with the criminal justice system by requiring that the victims report to law enforcement and also requiring that victims cooperate with the prosecutor if their case is proceeding down that track. The program is also the payer of last resort. An example is the 81-year-old who was beaten by the female acquaintance and her male accomplice. The elderly man, out of the goodness of his heart, had been giving money to this woman that he believed was in need of it for life's basic necessities. Unfortunately, he discovered that she had been using it to purchase drugs. He then refused to provide any additional funding for her, and as a result, the woman and her accomplice tied him up and assaulted him. A portion of this gentleman's injuries, the cost of his treatment for his injuries, was taken care of by Medicare. However, he required dental work that was not covered by any of his prior resources. So as a result, the Crime Victims Compensation Program was able to provide a little over $1,000 to help this gentleman with the cost of the dental work that was required as a result of this crime. Each application for crime victims compensation is reviewed to ensure that the crime was reported to police, that there was a serious injury to the applicant, that the applicant was not engaged in an illegal act at the time of the crime, and also that the victim did cooperate with the prosecution of the case. Benefits include assistance with crime-related costs up to a maximum of $44,000 per person, and the benefits include reimbursement for medical, dental, and counseling expenses, transportation, rehabilitation, time loss, funeral expenses, and loss of support. Again, I've given you a handout, this blue trifold, that will give you more detail on the eligibility requirements as well as the expenses for eligible victims. The program's key performance measure is the timeliness with which our section makes a decision whether to accept or deny an application. In January of 1999, our section had a significant backlog. At that time, we were only processing approximately 23% of our applications in less than 90 days. That meant at any given time, there were as many as 1,600 applications waiting to be processed. Our goal was to process at least 80% in less than 90 days, and that was based on my contact with other states and trying to find out what was the mean for processing crime victims' compensation applications. Due to additional funding that allowed us to establish a new case management system as well as additional staffing, today we routinely process 90% of our applications in under 90 days. In fact, for all but 2 months during the past 24 months, we have processed 75% of our applications in less than 60 days. The number of claims has increased steadily in each year. As you can see from the slide, in 1997, we processed only 2,190 claims. And in the year 2002, we processed 4,447 claim applications. In addition to processing new claims, the compensation program must remain current on paying victims for the reimbursement of their expenses. Most of our claims are open for 3 years, so this is yet another aspect of our program that requires our diligence and timeliness. The program paid out just under $2 million in calendar year 2001 and just over $2.6 million in calendar year 2002. Of course, you won't be surprised to know that the largest category for payments was medical costs. The payment trend is erratic, as you can see from the next slide, and this is due primarily to statutory changes to eligible expenses, along with changes in our staffing. There was a significant increase in payments between 1998 and 1999, after the 1997 legislative session. It was during that session that there was a significant change in eligible expenses. The caps on the medical expenses were doubled. The counseling expenses for children who witnessed domestic violence was added as an eligible expense. And the cost of medical assessments of alleged victims of child abuse was added. The drop that you see from 2000 to 2001 reflects implementation of a medical fee schedule. This has been very significant in helping us to contain medically related costs. The rise from 2001 to 2002 most likely reflects increasing medical costs along with increasing child abuse assessment costs.
Connie, yeah. Senator Devlin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a very brief question. For medical costs, this would normally be in circumstances where if the individual had their own health coverage, that the health coverage had the health coverage would cover it. This would be primarily compensating people that did not have coverage. Would that be correct? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, yes, this is correct. As the payer of last resort, all other insurance is expected to be used first before we would assume any costs. Crime Victims Compensation Program is funded by other fund, including the Criminal Fines and Assessment Account, and to a much lesser extent, federal funds. While applications continue to increase, and we expect that payments will also continue to increase despite our cost containment measures, the criminal fines and assessment allocation is decreasing, and it has never been adequate to address the need, as you can see from the slide that talks about biennials 99-01 up to the current time. In 1999-2001 biennium, the payments were approximately $4.5 million without the medical expenses, and yet our criminal fines and assessment allocation was roughly $3.5 million. When we look at the 2001-2003 biennium, the payments are estimated to be $4.1 million. However, the criminal fines and assessment public safety allocation will provide only $3.5 million, or perhaps a little less, this biennium. For the 2003-2005 biennium, the Crime Victims Compensation Program will receive under $2.7 million based on the governor's balanced budget. while we are projecting an estimated $4.5 million in payments. In the past, due to a 40% federal match on these dollars, as well as the additional revenue that comes into the criminal injuries compensation account, the program has been able to meet the needs of victims without significantly reducing reimbursement rates. However, I do need to point out what I'm sure you all know, that as the state expenditures decrease, so will the federal match upon which we've been dependent in order to meet these responsibilities. This is the section's only direct service program. It provided just under 4,000 victims with financial assistance in 1 year, from July 1, 2001 to June 30, 2002. The section administers two other programs that are supported by the criminal fines and assessment account. These two programs are the prosecutor-based victim assistance program and the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention account. The prosecutor-based victim assistance program was established in 1983. These programs ensure that victims are informed of their victims' rights throughout the criminal justice process. They assist victims with applying for crime victims' compensation. They support victims as the case proceeds through the system. They indirectly ensure greater likelihood that the offender will be held accountable. They provide support and referral as needed for the longer-term needs of victims. It was an advocate in one of these programs that helped the 21-year-old Japanese exchange student I referenced earlier, who was raped by her host father. It helped her to understand the American criminal justice system and also to access much-needed services. Also, here in Marion County, just to reference a case that I'm sure you've all read about in the paper recently, and that's the tragic death of Dionne Wilkes at the hands of her former boyfriend. Again, it was a local advocate through the prosecutor's program that was there to comfort and assist her family as they confronted the very difficult tasks that are associated with the murder of their only child. The local advocates are usually the first contact a victim has with the person who is there to answer their questions and support them as they maybe identify the body of a loved one or break the news of a criminal act to family members. Local advocates may provide death notification and crisis response in addition to accompanying victims as their case proceeds through the criminal justice system. And I'd like to assure you that these programs rely very heavily on volunteers. A very small portion of these services that I've just described are by paid staff, but both our office and the local offices spend a great deal of time trying to support the use of local community volunteers to assist with the provision of these services. This has been the very first biennium for all 36 counties to have at least a part-time victim assistance program. And our goal for our program is to support access to victim assistance of this type in every county and to enhance the professional development of victim advocates throughout the state. Great strides have been made in terms of access to these services for all victims, with Gillam County being the final county to come online with a part-time victim advocate. In addition, Oregon is on schedule for the development of a victim advocacy institute that will provide basic and advanced coursework on victimization, trauma, the criminal justice system, and a great deal more. This collaborative effort is spearheaded by a coalition of crime victim service providers, including the Department of Justice, that comprise the Crime Victims Assistance Network. This effort is supported by a multi-year federal grant. Funds earmarked for the victim assistance programs in the governor's balanced budget are approximately 25% less than our expenditure limitation was for the 0103 biennium. Not only will the just mentioned goals be in jeopardy, but the cuts will have an additional impact throughout the state. Statewide, it's likely that you will see a reduction in in-person services for victims. And I'd like to say that this is the very thing that victims mentioned to me that they most want after a crime. I attended a series of victim services public meetings throughout the state during the last year in cities such as LeGrand, Coos Bay, Hillsboro, and several others. And over again, I heard from victims that we want an advocate to be there right after the crime to help us understand what's going to happen with the criminal justice system and to help us access services. But what we will see is a reduction in or an absence of court and grand jury accompaniment, volunteer recruitment and training, and the hours that advocates will be available by phone as well as by person. county-specific examples are included in the slide that you see up there at this time. If an advocate is able to remain on staff, in-person services for all but the most serious crimes will be eliminated in many of our counties. Next, I'd like to talk about the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program. This program is the sole source of state funding for a multidisciplinary approach to assessment, investigation, and prosecution of child abuse cases. It provides funding for multidisciplinary teams in all 36 counties, as well as providing dollars for quality assessments that are provided through our assessment and advocacy centers. It provides for coordinated investigations between law enforcement and child protective services. It provides for child-sensitive investigations and medical assessments by specially trained physicians and interviewers. Quality assessment of complex cases, which is a particularly important aspect for the rural parts of the state, are also supported by these dollars. And high standards of professionalism across disciplines has been another outcome as well as a goal for this program. Law enforcement and child protective services must by statute be trained in specific areas of interviewing and investigation. They must also follow certain protocols. While these dollars don't replace good management, the program does ensure that each county has the funds for training and that the funds are used appropriately. It also ensures that each county has a protocol for investigation. This is very important because it reduces turf issues and it improves efficiency in terms of conducting the Child Protective Services investigation as well as the criminal investigation. It also means that child victims and family members do not need to repeat the account of the victimization over and over to multiple agency representatives. I'd like to say that in a past life I did work in Child Protective Services. And I would like to say that during the 1980s, before the CAMI program, it was not at all uncommon for a child to, first of all, have to disclose the abuse to a family friend or to a teacher, then to have to go through and recount the tale of her victimization again to a Child Protective Services worker, then to have to meet with a law enforcement officer and again have to go through the victimization that that child experienced, then perhaps to go visit a physician and again have to talk about the victimization, and finally to sometimes meet with a person from the district attorney's office and go through the account of the victimization again. Since the CAMI program, since the protocols are in place, since there's videotaping at the assessment centers, this just doesn't happen anymore. This is a very good thing for victims. The program provides partial support, financial support for the operation of 20 child abuse assessment and advocacy centers throughout Oregon. The map shows all 20 assessment and advocacy centers. Two of them are still in the developmental stage, the one in Clackamas County and the one in Curry County. All counties in Oregon have access to the assessment services if the funds are available to pay for such services. These centers, I'd like to mention, are not public entities. These are private nonprofits with independent boards. Some of them are affiliated with larger medical facilities, such as CARES Northwest's affiliation with Legacy Emanuel. All of the centers have significant support from their local communities and are supported by multiple types of funding. These centers are designed to be quiet, comforting, neutral settings for children with specially trained physicians and interviewers who have state-of-the-art equipment and technology that's conducive to evaluating both physical and sexual aspects of abuse. As stated, physicians that provide medical services at assessment centers have received specialized training. Not only are they better equipped by virtue of this training to conduct assessments of abuse in general, but they're also able to handle assessments that may represent more of a challenge, such as assessments of handicapped children, assessments of developmentally delayed children, and sometimes assessments of children whose parents perhaps are in the middle of a bitter custody dispute. For Child Protective Services and rural areas, this is a particularly valuable service that reduces the likelihood of misinterpreting allegations of abuse. It's essential that physicians and investigators be linked to resources that can assure the highest quality outcome. As this next slide shows, efforts have been made to assure quality services statewide by using technology to link physicians with one another. These dollars support peer review, along with a telemedicine project, where physicians across the state can consult with one another via a video and a computer link-up. The dollars also support a mentoring program for assessment center directors, as well as it's a quasi-mentoring program for physicians who want to specialize in child abuse and may be new in terms of their practice in a particular community. There are three regional centers that also serve the entire state. These regional centers provide specialized training and consultation along with assistance for the newly developing centers. The regional centers are located in Bend, Medford, and Portland. Oregon has spent approximately a decade building a state-of-the-art community-based system for alleged victims of child abuse. This is an extraordinary endeavor for the state and one that has reaped tremendous benefits for children and families. Not only does the current system provide first-rate medical and forensic response for children and their families, but it provides protection against bias interviewing and assessments by unskilled professionals. These dollars fund services that ensure that every single child in the state of Oregon who is alleged to be a victim of abuse can have a quality assessment that is conducted in a child-sensitive, yet a forensically sound manner. For the 2001-2003 biennium, the expenditure limitation for this program was $7.7 million. The governor's balanced budget presents an allocation of $5.8 million from the, again, the criminal fines and assessment account. The reduction of the dollars for this program will likely result in a loss of at least 11.4 FTE physicians, interviewers, or investigators. And approximately 4,000 children statewide would be denied timely access or receive no services at all from the assessment centers that I've referenced. Specific examples of possible county reductions can be seen on the next slide. Should there be a need for closure of assessment centers, even closing assessment centers one day a week would result in a significant delay in the ultimate finding of whether abuse or neglect has occurred, and certainly a potential delay in getting much-needed services to child victims. The department has three other grant programs that support services to victims of crime. These are...
Representative Hansen.
Quick question. Going back to the previous slide, if you reduce the number of assessments in Multnomah County, how would the decisions be made to triage? How would you decide which kids to examine and which kids are going to get the services and which aren't? Is that
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that would be decided at the local level, and my guess is that it would be decided by the multidisciplinary team in conjunction with the assessment center, that they would set a triage system. Okay. The three other state grant programs that the section administers are the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, the state grant program, and the federally funded program, the Victims of Crime Act. Each has its particular goal that's unique to the specific authorizing legislation, whether it's state or federal. The Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund was authorized in House Bill 2918 just last session. And this, as I said, is the first bill that resulted in sending general fund dollars out to the local communities for the provision of services to domestic violence and sexual assault victims. And its purpose is to increase the likelihood of safety for women, promote effective intervention, and the more global goal of reducing the incidence of domestic violence. The initial allocation was $2.5 million. Due to the budget shortfall, this money was cut by approximately $119,000 and was delayed in going out to the local providers. Most of the reduction was absorbed by administrative savings. As mentioned, in August 2002, 101 grants were issued to 49 private nonprofit agencies throughout the state to strengthen emergency services to both domestic violence victims and sexual assault victims, as well as to improve accessibility to these services for cultural minorities. You'll find a list of the grantees in the back of the green handout that I provided for you. Regional and county allocations, along with collaboration from the providers, assured that every county in our state did receive the benefit of these general fund dollars. The department's been cautious in regards to releasing these dollars. The final payment, which was due to the grantees in January, was discussed with legislative leadership before we released it to the grantees. Safety was the first and is the first and foremost goal for all recipients of these funds. 31 of the 49 agencies funded developed new strategies to assure that safety planning was conducted with all the appropriate clients. The most recent data from the domestic violence shelters shows that 92% of the clients in shelter are currently receiving safety assessments and safety plans. While the small amount of dollars that the programs receive from the source are not going to result in overnight changes in regards to safety for women, we do believe that this represents a catalyst for increasing commitment as well as focusing action towards that goal. The department also has authority to administer a nonspecific state grant program, provided that the balance in the criminal injuries compensation account is deemed adequate to meet the projected costs for payments of the crime victims compensation program. So all of the state grants that we issue are considered one-time grants, renewable only if resources can support the continuation of such grants. If the balance is adequate, the department may issue grants to public and private entities that provide services to victims of violent crime. Since July 1, 2001, the department has issued a civil legal assistance grant for victims of domestic violence, as well as a one-time capital improvement grant for domestic violence shelters. An emergency assistance grant was issued to the District Attorney Victim Assistance Programs to provide dollars for enhancing a victim's immediate safety, such as repair of door locks and windows, emergency prescriptions, along with food and shelter if there are no other resources available. The funds have also been used to support the implementation of an automated victim notification system. Smaller grants were also issued in 2001 for a needs assessment project, an elder abuse project in Native American communities, and a project to provide emergency assistance to disabled victims of crime in Multnomah County. In January 2001, the Department of Justice and the Department of Corrections signed an intergovernmental agreement to cooperatively develop an automated victim notification system. At this time, we have a 6-year contract in place to ensure that the system is fully implemented in our state. With innovations in technology, victims can now call a toll-free number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and receive what they view as critical information on the status of the perpetrator. They can find out release dates, date of possible parole, transfers, escapes, probation status, and other important custody information. Needless to say, not only is this a greater convenience for victims, but it also saves time on the part of probation officers and correctional staff in terms of having to return phone calls and answer questions, which is basically public information for victims. I'd also like to mention a 5-year-old girl that somebody else mentioned to me, and this 5-year-old girl asks her mother to call this number every night before she goes to bed, because this little girl needs to be reassured that her perpetrator is still behind bars and isn't going to come out and hurt her again. And again, I've provided you with a trifold brochure here that gives you a little bit more information on how the notification system operates. As of January 20th of this year, Oregon was one of the most active users nationwide of this notification system. There have been 24,712 incoming calls just since January of 2002, when the Department of Corrections and their institutions came online. So what is the future for these state grants? Well, it's difficult to project what the balance might be in the criminal injuries compensation account in 0305. The revenue stream is unpredictable, and it's certainly not within the control of the department to a large extent. At this time, it doesn't seem likely that the department is going to have the funds to cover the projected costs for the compensation program and continue to issue new state grants. The section receives 2 federal crime victims grants. Each year, a portion of the U.S. Victims of Crime Fund, which is administered by the U.S. Department of Justice, is appropriated for the Victims of Crime Act grants to each of the states. This money comes from fines, assessments, and penalties of federal offenders. The two grants that Oregon receives are non-competitive formula grants. The first one is the Crime Victims Compensation Grant. This is a 40% match on the state revenues that we have spent in the previous year on compensation payments to victims. In 2002, we received $190,000 through this grant. This is used in conjunction with the criminal fines and assessment allocation for compensation programs for victims who are eligible. The second federal grant we receive is the Victim Assistance Grant. This grant uses a population-based formula for state allocations. In federal fiscal year 2002, Oregon received $4.7 million and dispersed approximately $4.5 million to 101 programs throughout the state. Unfortunately, the federal appropriation for the Victim Assistance Grant is expected to decline between 13% and 15% in the federal fiscal year 2003. We have yet to receive that. The federal guidelines do require that each state disperse 10% of this federal grant to programs that provide services to victims of domestic violence. 10% also must be dispersed to programs providing services to victims of sexual assault, child abuse, and also to underserved populations. The U.S. Department of Justice Office of the Comptroller conducted a fiscal audit of this program in June 2002. They reviewed federal fiscal year 1999, 2000, and 2001. They provided us with three recommendations with which we concurred. We proceeded to implement those recommendations. And in October of 2002, we received a letter that acknowledged satisfactory completion. Seeking client feedback is an integral part of our programs. I'd like to close with a quote from a recipient of services that I believe succinctly expresses the importance of these programs and services for citizens in our state. Quote, "What Crime Victims Compensation Program did for me after my assault cannot be paid back, financially or in words. This is a fantastic program, and I'm grateful I was able to use it. Thank you so very much." This concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Connie. I will convene the full committee now that everyone's here. We're in a subcommittee of the sub, so everyone is here. And just for the committee's edification and for everyone in the audience, these programs are predominantly funded by the criminal fines and assessments account. I've been trying since I arrived at the Capitol to get from the court, which does the projections, where we're going into the next biennium, and the reason for the fall off in funds. I have asked both BAM through DAS, Bill McGee will come present next Thursday, as well as our LFO staff and the court staff, on what's happening with the criminal fines and assessments account so that this committee can get their arms around to some degree what it is. They're supposed to have the projections for the CFAA done by the 19th, and we would meet on the 20th. So hopefully everything will be in order, and that will give us a better idea of where the funding is on this program. And I know that there are a variety of bills out as to what happened with the criminal fines and assessments account. We substantially changed how it was going to be done last time, and it didn't meet with the expectations of what was done last legislative session. And then some of the things got scooped up in the governor's balanced budget this time that weren't intended to be scooped up as a result of the policy discussions that happened last time. So the chair's dropped a bill to at least put a placeholder in so that we may have the opportunity to work with the House Judiciary Committee at least. And I know that both the House and Senate Judiciary Committee are very well aware of this problem. I know that we have public testimony. Is there any questions for Connie before you let her go? Okay, thanks, Connie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
And we have three public members. If people hadn't asked to testify, but we do have Representative Kafori and Representative Smith here, so I'll ask them to come up first together to testify so they can get on about their business. And I need to... You've got a tape being eaten back here. So.
Ooh. Do we wait?
Yeah.
want to record you, of course.
We have really profound things to say, so we appreciate it. Well, wait.
Thank you. At this point in time, we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5525. We have Representative Forey and Representative Smith joining, Patty Smith joining us. There are too many Representative Smiths these days.
It's never too many.
Thank you. I'll go first. I just came down. I'm Representative Patty Smith. I represent East Multnomah, East Clackamas, and Hood River County. And as a advocate for domestic violence programs, I'm here today in support of the appropriation for the domestic violence programs and the bill that Representative Kefouri brought last session. I know these are budget, really short budget dollars, and I don't take this lightly, and I understand, and I'm glad that you guys are having to make these decisions and not me, and I know they'll come to us, but I just can't tell you how much I support this. During the interim, I worked on the Project No More, which was a zero tolerance of domestic violence. I sent out letters to all the legislators. It's just a passion of mine. In the 80s, I worked in the domestic violence programs in Baker County. I see firsthand the damage it does to our communities, to our families, and I'm just a strong supporter, so I'm here to advocate for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Deborah Kefouri from Northeast Portland, and I think I'm here obviously in the same portion of the Department of Justice budget. As we've had a lot of conversation the past couple weeks about prioritization and protecting our most vulnerable citizens, I would have to classify survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault in that category. I grew up in a house that was used at the time as a safe house for domestic violence victims, because there was no other place for them to go. And thank God we've moved beyond that, and now we have actual safe houses with staff who are trained and ready to protect women and children who are escaping these situations. But their funding is very precarious all over the state, and I'm sure you've heard how wonderful how well the money has been spent. It's gone out to every county in the state. I also wanted to remind everyone that House Bill 2918 from last session, which was Representative Devlin's bill, was really one of the best examples of what can happen in this process when people work together. It was a truly bipartisan effort. Urban, rural, Democrat, Republican, everybody came together to pass this bill because we saw the huge need and the huge importance. And I would hate to, I know we're in tough times, but I would hate to, after taking this giant step forward, have to take a giant step backwards in this area. So hopefully you guys can work some magic and find ways to keep this program funded. And if there's anything that Representative Smith or I can do to help, we would be more than happy.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Just for the record, Mr. Chairman, I would like to put on the record that Representative Kefouri and others did most of the work on the domestic violence. I was one of these fortunate parties who has a relatively modest bill that becomes the omnibus crime bill of the last session, but has all kinds of things put into it. So
all kinds of good things.
Yes.
Representative Hansen.
Certainly I don't have to explain to either of you in terms of the general fund obvious pressures and unitary assessment pressure. Is there any ongoing discussion strategies occurring, and this could, maybe the chair could also answer this, in terms of looking at other sources of, I'm thinking surcharge on marriage certificates, divorce filing fees, whole rate, you know, is there some type of strategy going, being developed for any other revenue sources for this activity? The funds are in jeopardy, but certainly the activity is valuable enough that we, if the funds disappear, we ought to be able to pursue every and any other source.
Representative Hansen, that's a very good question. In the 70s, there was the first time that actually there was a bill passed to put a filing fee on marriage licenses that was directed to domestic violence programs, and while that was a remarkable step at the time, and of course, my mother was one to sponsor that bill, so I'm, I think it was a good step. It hasn't been, we haven't been able to increase it enough, and there just really isn't a way to increase it enough to get the amount of dollars necessary. I mean, I think we did look into it when we were looking at funding mechanisms. Just to take a step back, we did a statewide survey 2 years ago before the previous session to address to try to address the need, to figure out how much money it would take to, for counties to feel like, and local programs to feel like they were able to adequately deal with the need in their counties. And the figure that we came up with was $75 million for a biennium. So we scaled that back to come to the legislature with a $25 million ask. That was in turn scaled back to a $2.5 million appropriation. You would have to, and I don't have the figures in front of me right now, but you would have to put a pretty hefty surcharge on marriage licenses to get that much money in.
I was using that.
Right.
I think that at least for these particular programs and in the current funding cycle, I think myself and many other people have been waiting until we get an idea from the courts as to what's happening with the criminal fines and assessments account so we can really evaluate. We identified the criminal fines and assessments account during the 1999 session. We last session we passed some legislation in the 99 session which had a fairly significant bump in the money that the state was collecting through the criminal fines and assessments account. We changed the criminal fines and assessments account, but we're not meeting the projections that we thought we were going to achieve. So I think until we get that, I mean, we can look at adding on to the unitary assessment. We can look at our collections efforts. So that's kind of where I've been in a holding pattern before we go outside of this particular account right now.
Mr. Chairman, not to prolong this issue, but does in their look at this issue, they're being asked also to take into consideration the probable slowdown in the courts in terms of what we're doing and cutting back hours in the courts.
That is correct. And I've actually I actually have a call in to Tom Potowski. This is will be part of all the forecast stuff that we're going to get for the economic forecast. This will be a component of that. I've asked on this as well as losing revenue officers to make sure that the revenue office, the loss of revenue officers, as well as the tobacco task force that we heard about here, if to make sure that those, to find out whether those are included or excluded from the forecast results. So I think that that'll be important as we all try and face this pretty difficult budget situation to know whether those are included or excluded. Otherwise, we may have another $30 or $40 million hole above and beyond what the revenue forecast is.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you. I just wondered, as you're looking at the criminal fines and assessment account, to zero in on some additional funding for the domestic violence. I know that a number of people are being assigned to the anger management and other counseling. Are those programs such that they just that they even come close to paying for themselves, or are there portions of the funds that come from those accounts? Or those diversions that could be used to assist in this regard?
Well, I think I'm not sure about all those. We're going to have an opportunity
okay.
through some of the community corrections, local community corrections grants and other things to take a look at how some of that money is being passed down at the local county level and how they're dealing with some of those funds.
And then a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm wondering if we will have enough money come out of general government that could be available for hats, wands, and rabbits. It sounds like we're going to have to pull something out of the hat. So she wants us to work.
Maybe we should put up a piggy bank
a
for wands, rabbits, and hats.
This is the beef hat.
All right. Anything further, Senator George?
Just real quickly. I have something that's troublesome to me, and I'll ask you two if you know how it's going. And Connie, you maybe know about this too. And my wife's been a board member, and we always go to fundraise for Juliet House in Yamhill County. And I noticed this year, and the response that I got from my boss was that, people are hurting, so they just aren't coming. It's relatively expensive. Are we seeing, because a lot of these programs are, you know, sponsors and donations and fundraisers, are we seeing a reduction statewide? Do you guys have any feel for that? Because, I mean, it just adds to the burden.
Connie, you want to?
Connie might have some specific answers, but I do know that charities around the state are all facing similar tough times because as people get laid off and they don't have as much expendable income, they don't have as much to give to programs.
And I might add to that, that causes an even added strain to the very problem we're talking about.
That was my point. Yeah. Exactly.
Connie.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank
you. We appreciate you, taking
much.
Time out of your schedules to come down.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, from the state perspective, yes, it does appear as though programs are struggling due to the lack of charitable giving at this point in time. But I noticed that there are some directors of some of these private nonprofits who I'm sure would be happy to answer your question specifically in regards to their situation.
Well, I just assume, I assume based upon that we probably had it down for.
I have the sign-up sheet up here. We can put it back. Maybe we'll put it on a piece of paper. Do we have another copy? I have Nancy Glines and is it Annie Anderson or Tony Anderson and Claudia Weber? Those are the three that I've got on the list, just so people know. I don't know if any of you are grouped together or not. If you're grouped together, please come up together if you'd like. Otherwise, you don't have to. I don't even know if you know each other. I'm sure they probably all know each other. Why don't you go ahead and begin, Nancy.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Glines, and I'm the Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services in Eugene, Oregon. I'm here today in support of the Department of Justice budget, particularly the funds for the sexual assault and domestic violence programs. Our agency exists to support survivors of sexual violence and to change the societal inequities that allow sexual violence and oppression to exist. SAS strives to create an empowering environment and a continuum of services for survivors of sexual violence, their families, and their friends. Violence against women and children permeates our daily lives and our society. Sexual assault touches all of our lives at some level. According to a study by Perso and Roth, the rate of sexual assault in the United States is the highest of any industrialized nation in the world. The Department of Justice reports that every two minutes a woman is sexually assaulted, and in the United States, by the time a child reaches 18, one in three girls and one in five boys will have experienced some form of sexual abuse. Providing direct services to those who have been sexually abused is essential. It is equally vital to address the underlying causes of sexual violence through educating our community, especially the youth. Our community education and schools program reach thousands of students each year, not only helping to prevent sexual assault and abuse, but also by challenging students to think about gender role expectations. The money SAS received in August through the DOJ allowed us to expand our community education and prevention programs into more high schools and middle schools throughout the county. Part of the money was also used to fund a bilingual advocate in order to reach out to the Latina community, which is reported to be the fastest growing minority population in the state, and it comprises approximately 4% of the Lane County population. We now have all of our information and referral packets translated into Spanish and are currently working with leaders in the Latina community to extend our services to the community by offering support groups and other advocacy services. If we don't continue to receive the money that funds this position, this advocacy and outreach is in jeopardy. During the past couple of months, we have seen an increase in the number of women with mental health issues who have been assaulted. These women are from one of the most vulnerable populations in the state. With the recent cuts to mental health care, many of these women have lost their homes and access to the medications they so desperately need. They become easy prey for the sexual predators in the community. During November and December, SAS advocates spent approximately 60 hours working with one of these women. The issues around her case were compounded by the perceived lack of credibility that she had. The numbers of these kinds of assaults are only going to increase as economic times get worse. Without money to hire and train advocates to help women and children in these situations, many will not be able to receive the help, comfort, and services they so desperately need. On one Saturday in December, one of the SAS advocates spent 13 hours with a young woman who had been assaulted and needed accompaniment to the hospital and support as she worked with the police to file a report. The SAS advocate stayed with her through the entire 13 hours, supporting her, helping her to know what the next step in the process was, and advocating her so that she had all the facts and knew what her rights were while dealing with the medical and legal system. The system is daunting in the best of times, but when someone has gone through the trauma of an attack, it is overwhelming, and without the help and support of the advocate, many women choose not to report or even go in for medical help. I'd like to close with a quote from a survivor who received a stalking protective order with our help, and she said, "There's a huge gap between the legal system and the average person. It's like there's a huge chasm that you have to cross if you want to get help, and it's so hard to find a way across on your own. You are like a guardian angel standing on a precarious bridge, lighting the way and guiding me over. Since I got the stalking protective order, there have been no further contact from my stalker. I'm feeling stronger and safer. I have developed more clear and assertive boundaries. And after years of living with fear, doing this turned out to be one of the best things that's ever happened. I could not have been able to do this without your help. This is only one way that agencies such as ours can continue to offer these there's only one way that agencies such as ours can continue to offer these invaluable services to the community, and that is with the continued financial support of the DOJ and the legislature. Thank you."
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Ms. Anderson.
Okay. Hi, I'm Toni Anderson. I'm here with the Central Oregon Battering and Rape Alliance, which is also known as COBRA. It's a nonprofit agency in Central Oregon covering four counties, which are Crook, Deschutes, Jefferson, and Grant counties. So actually, the closest we are to any of you is John Day, oddly enough. So we've been in the area for 25 years. We provide comprehensive family violence and sexual assault services. Our core services are emergency shelter for women and children, support groups, individual peer counseling, and community education, including high school and middle school presentations. That, as many of you might already know, that a lot of this work started in the late 70s. It's a very grassroots effort, and it was all volunteer. And it's pretty different these days, that it's actually a much more sophisticated effort in working with survivors. That, one, we look at our business practices. And COBRA is a million-dollar agency. We have multiple funding streams, so I can answer maybe a few of those questions you might have about the different ones. They change every year, and the amounts are up and down all the time. This year, of course, we're facing some really serious cuts to a number of our funding sources. So our business practices are much different. We always operate with less than 20% admin, though, no matter what goes on. Also, our relationships, our professionalism has really changed, that with the alliances we have with our government agency partners and the community collaborations really require more professionalism, which is difficult to sustain when we have very low-paid staff, and it's very high-stress work, so it's high turnover. It's really difficult to maintain that kind of professionalism. The knowledge that we're expected to have has also really changed over time. That there was a time when working with survivors meant talking about the cycle of violence and maybe doing some safety planning, and then that was pretty much kind of it. But now we're really expected to be experts not only in domestic violence and sexual assault, but mental health issues, drug and alcohol addictions, and knowing the ins and outs of the legal system. So it's a very complex issue. It's much different these days. I wanted to let you know a little bit about the unique role of advocates, that we work closely with all of our partners, but it's very different than what police officers do or welfare caseworkers or emergency room nurses. And the role of the advocate is really to walk beside her, give her information and referral, real accurate information, but it's mostly to help her make her own decisions, to let her make her own decisions, that most survivors are coming from a long history of a very controlling relationship. And we know after 25, 30 years of this work that really the only way to get out of that is to empower that person, to give them the right to make decisions over their own life. As Deborah Cafori said, the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund was a giant step forward. That was a huge accomplishment in the last session to bring those monies forward. And to let you know how we saw that in Central Oregon, we received three grants, and we were able to increase our salaries. The average salary across the state prior to this were around $8 to $10 for advocates for an hourly wage. We went from $11 to $13 an hour. In Central Oregon, it's been identified that $15 an hour is a living wage. So we're not quite there, but we are managing to keep staff. We haven't had any turnover since this grant. We opened an office in Redmond, which is the north end of Deschutes County and one of the fastest growing cities in Central Oregon, or actually in the state. And we know from opening our other offices that in analyzing our statistical data over the last few years, whenever we open a site, our numbers just spike, that it's much different than calling a hotline to be able to walk in and talk to an advocate. And we also know that because of the population increases in Central Oregon, we increase services pretty consistent. With as those numbers grow, so do the demand for our services. So we're thrilled to have this site in Redmond. As part of that, we were able to hire a volunteer manager full-time who is working with 100 direct service volunteers that provide 4.5 FTE for direct services and doing the support groups and answering the hotline. And we added two other positions. One was an intake advocate at the shelter to work with people. We know that that's the highest risk for survivors when they leave an abusive situation, so this person really concentrates on that transition of coming into shelter. And we hired a rural sexual assault coordinator that works in Prineville, that works with actually Grant, Jefferson, and Cook counties in coordinating the services between the hospitals, law enforcement, and the advocates. So bringing in some training. As Representative Butler, I'm sure you're aware of, it's very difficult to get training as you leave this side of the mountains, that people don't have the resources. If someone leaves their agency for a three-day training in Salem, there's maybe not a police officer there to respond. So training is a real issue on these concerns. So this position really helps with the sexual assault response. And I think the best way to really illustrate the value of these funds and what they're doing are what's happening to the families in the state of Oregon. So I brought just a couple of vignettes that I'd like to share with you that all happened over the last month. And these are all from the perspective of the advocates at the shelter. There is a woman who has come to Bend from another state fleeing domestic violence. Her abusers found her in other shelters. Hopefully she'll be safe here. She's a very talented woman and is struggling to break a drug addiction. It seems more and more women are coming to us with meth addictions, addictions which probably would not have started if they had never met their abuser. We have a client in the shelter that seems to be very motivated towards making changes and improvements in her life. She's been looking for work every day and says her self-esteem has greatly improved. She came here from another shelter. Her abuser knew where that shelter was. Another story is, I worked with a sexual assault survivor that really affected me, the advocate. I really had to work on my personal feelings about the perpetrator. This young woman's stepfather started molesting her when she was about 4 years old and went on until she was about 10. She just recently reported it. He was briefly jailed and then released and scheduled for a follow-up court hearing to determine his future. During this time, he had no contact order with the victim, the woman she was working with, but he has been contacting her through email, attempting to manipulate and coerce her to help him beat this. He wants her to tell the court that she lied. He's using all kinds of tricks with creating self-blame, guilt, fear, etc. We gave her the option of reporting him since it is against the law for him to have any contact with her. She's very confused. She feels sorry for him, thinks his family will blame her if he gets sent away, feels it's partly her fault, and can't figure out a way to justify how to hold him accountable without the guilt. Another story is, I have a new elderly client, 82 years old, who has been in a domestic violence marriage for 47 years. She came to me because she's finally gone through with the filing for a divorce and wanted to know where to look for the resources for the elderly. We spoke for 2 hours on her first visit to Cobra about what feelings she was going through, such as wanting to go back to her husband since, quote, she's lived with this life for 47 years and doesn't know anything different, end quote. She did a lot of self-blaming and thought that wanting to go back was not normal. We talked about the cycle of violence and how nothing she did made her deserve to be hit or called names. We went over some literature that I gave her and discussed that everything she was feeling was legitimate, but that when she was ready to leave for good, that there were resources in the community to help her. She left our office feeling more empowered than when she'd come. She had hoped that she would survive on her own and that she didn't need to go back to her previous lifestyle. And the last story is, I had a client come in who was concerned about her daughter's molester being released from prison because of Measure 28 not passing. We discussed a safety plan for her daughter and what she could do to keep her safe. One of her safety options was going to the neighbor's house. After talking with her neighbor, the neighbor designed a ladder on each side of the fence in the backyard so that she could easily run out the back door and escape over to the neighbor's yard if the father came back to the house. I'm also getting her an emergency cell phone to carry with her at all times since there's a threat of the father trying to take her out of school. They're going to start coming to support groups and working through this crisis together. So these are just daily stories, and there are many, many of them. So I hope that gives you a flavor of what's going on in these programs. And so in conclusion, I wanted to make a note that last year in 2002, there were 37 deaths due to domestic violence in the state of Oregon, including 9 children. And with the cuts that we're facing and without the continuation of these funds, we have good reason to believe violence will increase in our communities. And there's a great likelihood that deaths will increase, homicides and murders will increase due to domestic violence as well. But it's my belief that every community deserves these very basic core services, just as every community should have a firehouse and a police station and a hospital. Domestic violence and sexual assault services should be available to everyone. And I really plead for your support in continuing this very essential fund. Thank you.
Weber.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Weber. I'm the Director of Rape and Sexual Assault Services for Portland Women's Crisis Line in Multnomah County. I'm going to try very hard not to be redundant with all of the wonderful information my colleagues have given you. We share all of the same problems, stories, and energies. I do want to tell you, though, how the reduction of these funds will affect rape and sexual assault survivors in the Multnomah County area as well as the Tri-County area. We're a relatively new program, probably one of the newest in the state, and the only private nonprofit in the Multnomah County area that provides services to survivors of sexual assault, their families, friends, both current and past. We provide a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week crisis line as well. And so the calls come into our crisis line, and at the moment we have approximately 23 volunteers that respond one-on-one, face-to-face, in hospitals, law enforcement agencies, coffee shops sometimes at 3 a.m., and in survivors' homes if necessary, as long as law enforcement is there to keep our advocates and our volunteers safe. These services are the beginning of the healing process for survivors. Without these advocates, to be able to speak with a survivor one-on-one, to hold a hand, to wipe away a tear, and to be there during a sexual assault forensic exam kit if they should choose to report, the healing process does not begin. Post-traumatic stress disorder, rape trauma syndrome starts to take effect, and we're going to lose people into the mental health system even further, as well as the fact that their lives will never, ever come back to any type of coherent consistency. These funds have allowed my program to, for me to have help, actually, and I'm currently no longer working 80 to 100 hours a week. I now have a volunteer coordinator who is in charge of my volunteers and advocates. And so we're probably sharing about 60 hours a week apiece at this point. We also we do a lot of community education in the Multnomah County, Tri-County area, going out to schools, teaching teenagers and adolescents on how to be safe, how to stay safe from sexual assault, and also how not to become a perpetrator of a sexual assault. So these funds, especially in our economic atmosphere, with the reduction of 9 district attorneys in Multnomah County, with the reduction of 2 full-time paid advocates in the Multnomah County Victim Assistance Program in the district attorney's office, those reductions would be a huge setback to victims of survivors of sexual assault, especially in the Multnomah County area, where we're finally able to provide services to survivors, whether they choose to report or not. So rather than repeat what has already been said, I also urge you to please, whatever can be done to save these funds so we can save lives and families and mental health status. Certainly Multnomah County thanks you tremendously, as well as all the survivors of sexual assault.
I have a question for all three of you. Something that's been brought to my concern, we brought it out last session a little bit too, was I know that all of you receive multiple funding streams,
probably not only from through various state agencies, whether it be DHS, whether it be DOJ, and federal grants. I'm wondering, I know that there's a lot of duplication in what you're being asked to produce and the auditing that goes on of your various programs. Can you tell me if you have any idea on how we could help to streamline the process so that you're not spending wasting so much of your time on the administrative process of reporting to DHS, DOJ, and whatever other grant funding streams from whatever divisions you have? Do you have an idea as to, could you just speak real briefly to that?
Or if that's
a problem. I assume that it's a problem. But
one suggestion is that if the state would just grant $150 million to domestic violence and sexual assault for DOJ, we'd be very happy. So I think this has been talked about quite a bit in a number of different, and actually it has improved. The funders are meeting together, and they've really tried to, they have one reporting form. So it actually has gotten better. There's also an effort right now to support programs in their data collection and to help them come up to speed. I think we're a ways off from that because also the size of programs vary greatly across the states. That there are some really small programs where the director's answering the hotline, and COBRA's one of the largest programs. So it's going to be difficult to get that standardized data collection to begin with. Pretty much those discussions have come around to, if it were one agency managing it, of course it would be. That would facilitate the process so that it didn't have to go through different reporting.
Maybe you tell me, too, how many state agencies you, or state divisions you have funding through so that I have an understanding of it, so that the committee has an understanding of it.
Well, I know that COBRA has 18 federal and state grants combined,
and
the state agencies that we deal with are DOJ, the state police, and DHS.
We have probably state and federal, there's probably 10 different agencies. A couple of them, we get a couple of grants through the same agency, so but streamlining the reporting system and also the fact that not every agency has the ability to have all of the computer hardware and software that's necessary to support this reporting.
Mm-hmm. And the crisis line has approximately 10 to 15 funding sources as well between the county, the state, and federal funding sources. And so we're also struggling with the multi tasking of reporting and the duplication.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question relative to dealing through the Department of Justice for your issues dealing with domestic violence and needing $150 million to solve all the problems. Is there any way that we could assist in speeding up or in assisting with reduction of paperwork? And do you have any specific suggestions that you give our committee that would be a benefit to the delivery at getting the water to the end of the row at your local level?
Would there be a possibility to come back to you with an answer? I think if
you wanted to formulate that and direct it to the chair, that'd be wonderful.
I think we're very interested in seeing where the advocacy community feels that the how we can best coordinate those efforts and eliminate some of the duplicative reporting and auditing and maybe staffing that we have so that you can put more on the ground.
I'd also just like to express appreciation for the knowledge about the unitary assessment. That's impacting our programs greatly as well. So thanks for being aware of that.
Thank you. We have two more people on the list. Mr. Williams, Gary Williams, who is the Crook County District Attorney.
Thank you, Chair Partridge and members of the committee. My name is Gary Williams. I'm the District Attorney in Crook County, and I'm the current president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I am pleased to speak in support of the Department of Justice budget today. Elected district attorneys absolutely depend on three important programs in the Department of Justice: the District Attorney's Assistance Program, the Appellate Division, and Crime Victims Program. And I'd like to speak as to each of those three programs. First is the DA Assistance Program. There are various services that the DA Assistance Program provides to local DAs that are absolutely essential, and those include investigative support and investigative services in complex cases, for example, in financial fraud cases, in organized crime investigations, in racketeering prosecutions. Local DAs, especially DAs in smaller counties, have no expertise in that area and might see those cases once every 5 years or whatever. And so we depend on the Department of Justice investigative services to help us through those cases. Sometimes it's to the point where we cannot proceed with a case unless we get the expertise and the services from Department of Justice. Another very important part of the DA Assistance Program is training. Our primary training source for local prosecutors in Oregon is the DA Assistance Program. For some counties, for many counties, it's our only source of training, Department of Justice training. They sponsor and provide continuing legal education to hundreds of prosecutors every year, and the training is of the highest quality. They have on staff attorneys who have been specially trained in presenting and in training, and there also are experienced prosecutors who have been there and done it for years, and so they have high quality attorneys offering high quality training that is needed to local prosecutors, especially again in the smaller counties. They also provide publications to us. They have training manuals, legal publications, research, resources, information on recent developments in the law at reduced cost to us, so that the DA's offices can afford these publications, can afford to stay current, and of course our effective work depends on staying current on the law and being informed on changes by the appellate courts and, of course, by legislative action. And the DA Assistance Program is our primary source for that information. They also give us technical advice. They have, for many years, they have had a staff attorney whose main function is to provide, on very short notice, technical advice and assistance to prosecutors who may call that attorney any time of the day and sometimes any time of the night when an urgent issue comes up that a local prosecutor needs advice or assistance on. I myself have done that dozens and dozens and dozens of times over the past 19 years, called up the number that I've had memorized for a long time and asked to speak to the assigned attorney to provide technical assistance, give him the question, and I'll have the answer in maybe 5 seconds or maybe 5 minutes during a recess of a court hearing or a trial. It's a very valuable resource for local prosecutors. Prosecution assistance in complex cases. Already talked about investigative assistance in complex cases, but also we ask the DA Assistance Program to simply prosecute cases for us, and most commonly that would involve homicide cases. And again, I don't want to give you the impression that the DA Assistance Services are limited to smaller counties, but the fact is that Multnomah County has a crew of attorneys who can handle aggravated murder cases pretty well. Maybe there are 30 other counties who don't have, or 25 other counties who don't have that capability. And so we rely on the expertise and the experience of assistant attorneys general to handle homicide cases, particularly aggravated murder cases. Those have developed into a real specialty and a very complex area of the law, and I know that in the county of Crook, we haven't had an aggravated murder case in the last 50 years or so. But if we did, I wouldn't even start it. The first thing I would do is call the DA assistance program and ask them to prosecute the case. Mostly because of knowledge and expertise that I lack, and also because of resources that our local counties lack. I would also like to speak briefly about the appellate division. As you probably know, local prosecutors don't do any of their own appellate work. The appellate division does all of it, and so we absolutely, if a case is going to be appealed by the state, then the Attorney General's office does it. And if the case is appealed by the defense, then the Department of Justice represents us in those appeals. And so for the successful prosecution and effective prosecution of cases, we rely 100% on the appellate division of the Department of Justice. Finally, I would like to address the crime victims program. Victims are the prosecutor's best evidence, and they are the prosecutor's most important evidence, most important resource in the case. And we have to do what we can to develop that resource and to utilize that evidence in successful prosecutions. We can't do it without support. Local offices, local district attorneys' offices cannot do it alone. We need help from, of course, every office in the state has some level of victim services. Some offices have large offices, large victim assistance offices, and then other DA's offices have a half-time person, but whatever. Every DA's office has a type of victim services, and those victim services need support, and they need training, and they are in desperate need of funding. And I know you've heard lots about funding, and you know about funding from Crime Victims Program. I don't believe there's a county, and I haven't done a survey this morning, but I don't believe there's a county that doesn't receive funds directly or indirectly, pass-through funds from the Department of Justice Crime Victims Program that goes into the local counties. And we cannot adequately train and support victims' advocates, and we can't fund our victims' advocacy program without assistance from the Department of Justice. Thank you.
Question? Thanks for joining us today, Mr. Webb.
Kevin Galley.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Dowling, and I work at CARES Northwest. We're a child abuse assessment center in Portland, but we serve the Portland Tri-County area. I sit on three multidisciplinary teams, one in Clackamas County, one in Washington County, and one in Multnomah County. Also, we receive funding as a regional training and consultation center, and so we serve 21 counties across northern Oregon, providing consultation, education, training to other professionals that are seeing kids for concerns of abuse. I wasn't planning on speaking today, but I heard your questions, and I think I could answer them at least from a CARES perspective. Representative Hansen, you had asked about how would we decide which children that we wouldn't see, and that's a really good question. At CARES, we see on average about 6 children a day. It's been a busy week. This week on Tuesday we saw 11 children. Yesterday we saw 9. Today we'll see 8. On Tuesday, 3 of those 11 were emergency cases. Cases where either law enforcement or child protective services was needing some immediate assistance in figuring out what are they going to do in those cases. Or cases where a child has been raped or assaulted or beaten and has physical signs and symptoms that need medical attention. In looking at where those cuts would be made, we're estimating that probably a little over 300 children would not be seen with the reductions in CAMI funding. Probably one of the first places we would look to cut would be those emergency appointments, mainly because CARES Northwest is able to have a physician or a nurse practitioner and a trained interviewer available each day, so that if there's a case that comes in, we can provide that expert medical exam, we can provide that interview that afternoon. Unfortunately, we don't know when those cases are coming in, and it's hard to budget for that. So we try to set aside each day to have a team available. Some days we have no cases come in. Other cases we have three or four or five emergency cases. What that means is probably with those calls or those cases, those children would need to go to local emergency departments to be seen, and maybe then get referred to CARES. Some of the concern with that is that one of the main benefits of a child abuse assessment center, as Ms. Gallagher had mentioned, was reducing the number of times the children have to be interviewed or examined. And so there'd be a concern that they'd go to the emergency department, have an exam, somebody would talk to them there, and then maybe be referred to CARES the next day. But again, in terms of looking at our budget at CARES, that's one of the areas that we're considering cutting. I think another area might be in looking at the types of cases that get referred to CARES. We might need to be a little more stringent on the children that actually come in for an assessment. So just as an example, we might require that a child give a real clear disclosure to law enforcement or Child Protective Services before scheduling them for a CARES evaluation. Right now, a physician from the community can refer to CARES, a family can refer to CARES. Because we see kids only when there's a concern of abuse, we're often reporting and working closely with law enforcement or Child Protective Services. But they don't necessarily have to tell all the details to somebody from law enforcement or Child Protective Services in order to be seen. And so I think we might raise that bar a little bit. And so there'd be a section of cases here that probably would not be seen that might be referred back to their primary care provider, or where law enforcement would be doing an interview in the field, or Child Protective Services would be doing an interview in the field. What we lose with that is the opportunity to intervene early. And what we know is that for most children, and we see kids from birth up to 14 primarily, most of them, the disclosure about abuse is more of a process. It's not a one-time event. And so it's not uncommon for them to be uncomfortable or not want to talk with, say, a law enforcement person. And again, we have a center that's designed for children. We have a center that has an interview room where a detective and a CPS worker, Child Protective Service worker, can sit in an observation area, listen in, observe that interview, so that they're not having to ask that child the same kinds of questions and that child's having to talk about that over and over. So those would be a couple places where we would probably look to make cuts if we had to. The question about funding that you had asked, Senator George, we have seen a reduction in fundraising this year. We have an annual event called the Black Tie Bowl-O-Rama. It's in the springtime. We had to cancel that event last year for the first time in 4 years. One of the main reasons was that some of the sponsors of the event were calling us and saying, we really support your program. We really believe in what you're doing for the children of our community, but we're having to make decisions about keeping staff or giving to the community, and we want to keep staff, and we certainly would support that. So we did see a reduction. We usually raise around $45,000 in that event, and that was one of the areas where we saw that go down. Are there any other questions that, while I'm here? Okay. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Anyone else wishing to testify? If not, we'll close the public hearing. Attorney General Myers, did you have anything?
Sure, thank you. It's my understanding that the subcommittee will be returning to the budget at a later point after some further information is gathered. If it would be agreeable, I'd like to wait until we get into the work session environment, if that would be okay with you.
Thank you. I'd asked also, I'd encourage members to look at we asked several questions. They put a lot of effort into these questions. There's some good provocative questions. I think that were answered. Representative Hansen's question regarding the possible statutory changes to lessen the workload. I've already run by Bill Taylor up at the Judiciary Committees, as well as Legislative Council, to take a look at that, see if that's something we want to, and I've asked the department to comment on that. I've also asked the department to get back to me on some further questions. So if people have further questions, please get them to Doug, and then Doug can pass them along to the department so we get things answered.
Mr. Chair, in that regard, could I just have to make clear that all of the questions that we're asking are detailed on the tracking memo we gave the members
right.
are in process, and we will have we'll get those to you as they are finished as quickly
right.
as we can. So.
And we certainly appreciate that, and we know that some of these things take a substantial amount of time to answer, and we appreciate the department responding. We've got some real tough decisions to make. So, if nothing further.
Yes. Before you, you do have a packet of information that will be for the hearings next week. On Monday, you'll be hearing from Board of Investigators. Who's doing those hearings?
Thanks. Representative Hanson.
I'm always afraid in this tight budget environment that when we get our questions back, there will be cost to compile this information, $385 or whatever the cost is for answering the questions that we so glibly ask. It's a tremendous amount of effort sometimes to get us our answers.
It is. And hopefully there's a few kernels in there that we can make a difference incrementally in what we do. And believe me, we read them. So we should read them if we don't. All right. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I certainly appreciate it. And we're adjourned.
Come on, Logs.